This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Battle Creek Inquirer government reporter Jennifer Bowman introduces us to Claire Briggs. She won election to the Battle Creek City Commission in 1925, becoming the city's first female city commissioner. But first, last week, Lieutenant Governor Brian Calley announced a new ballot initiative that would make Michigan's legislature part-time. Gongwer News Service editor Zach Gorchow says it's unclear whether or not this would make Michigan's government better, but it is clear that it would make Michigan's legislature unique. Zach Gorchow joins us from the studios of the Michigan Public Radio Network in Lansing. Thanks for being with us, Zach.
Thanks for having me, Gordon.
So if Michigan were to go ahead, put this on the ballot and voters approved making the legislature part-time, and if Michigan kept the current term limits structure that the state has, how unique would the state be?
There would be no other state in the nation with a legislature that combines a part-time legislature, a pretty strict term limits law, which says no more than 6 years for a member of the House and 8 years for the Senate, and a lifetime limit on how many terms someone can serve in the legislature. A lot of states have term limits, but it just says you can only serve so many terms consecutively, but you could take a term off and then come back. Michigan, once you serve 6 years in the House or 8 years in the Senate, you're done for life. We would be the only state in the nation like that.
And once the legislature became part-time, if it did, you would have people then who would only be serving for 90 days a year under the lieutenant governor's ballot proposal. So not a lot of time to really learn the ropes during any 1 year or 2 years, et cetera.
Right. And one thing that people should understand is there's a lot of different part-time legislatures out there. There's some legislatures that only meet every other year. This proposal would have the legislature meet annually, which is, I think, how most part-time legislatures do it. But other states would say, well, you get this many days, but you got to finish by this date, maybe June 1st. This is pretty strict. It says 90 consecutive days, and then you're done. And I don't think anybody thinks they're going to meet 7 days a week, for 90 consecutive days. So you're probably talking about something more on the order of 70 to 75 days, maybe, if that, in session days. And then that doesn't account for holidays or anything like that. So you're probably talking less than 70 actual session days of activity.
Of course, the lieutenant governor is promoting this in part for cost savings, but you raised some questions in your blog post about how much you can really save if all you're talking about is the salaries and benefits of the lawmakers. If you're really going to find savings, you got to find it elsewhere, right?
Yeah, that's right. If you were to just cut the legislators' salaries roughly in half, you could save about $4.5 million a year. But the lieutenant governor said this could save tens of millions of dollars. That's a direct quote. The only way you could do that would be to just chip away, and more than chip away, hammer away at the staff of the legislature. And there's not that much staff when you get down to it. Each House member has one or two, except for the leadership or key posts, they have some more. Senators have anywhere from 3 to 5 staff members. And then you have what you could call the professional staff. These would be the people who work for the House and Senate fiscal agencies, economists, budget experts who really do the nuts and bolts that allows the budget to come together. You've got attorneys all over the staff who actually write the statutes. And the thing of it is, with Michigan's strict term limits law, the real expertise in the legislature these days, except for a few senators who have really developed some expertise over the years on a particular subject, is with the staff. And so if you do end up blowing up a lot of the staff, then where are you?
And people like, for instance, the House and Senate Fiscal Agency. I mean, you have a quote here from Edward Canfield saying that, a legislature only has 2 to 4 years experience is going to have a tough time trying to work their way through a budget for something complex like, say, Health and Human Services.
Yeah, he's a state representative from the Thumb, who is the chair of the budget committee that writes the Department of Health and Human Services budget. That is the largest budget in state government. It is enormous. It is very complex. You're talking about Medicaid. You're talking about welfare programs, public health, And on and on and on. There's more here than we could get to. And he very candidly said recently, you know, this is really not a chairmanship that makes sense for somebody who only has 2 or 4 years on the job. And that's something I think everybody who is in or around the Capitol sort of intuitively understands, but it's so seldom that somebody in that position would be candid enough to say it publicly.
And then there's also the issue of constituent service, which often falls to the staff of these lawmakers who you mentioned, and normally not a big staff, but this is sort of the front lines, the people who will take the call saying, hey, this doesn't work, or I had a problem with this state agency. Is the concern here that those people would not be available if you're really going to make the cuts that get those tens of millions of dollars of savings?
Well, it's unclear. I mean, you know, the lieutenant governor's saying, well, it'll be up to the legislature to decide how much staff they want to have. And that's true under this proposal. But if they really want to save money, they'll have to cut staff. So the question would be, do you have full-time staff when the legislature is not in session? Are people there 5 days a week like they are now? I mean, usually what happens is a constituent calls and says, you know, I got denied my Medicaid application, or, you know, M53, there's an enormous sinkhole that's formed in the middle of it. And I can't get through to anybody at the Department of Transportation. That's just a hypothetical. And what usually then happens is the staff there, they will then contact the department. And sometimes you have to get the legislator themselves involved to intervene if they feel like they're not getting a real answer from the department. You know, the lieutenant governor's saying they're only going to work 90 days. They can go back and work their regular career. But what happens on what I would describe as the not infrequent occasion when staff needs to talk to the legislator about what to do to get involved during non-session times? I mean, this would be an interesting situation.
And a not-so-hypothetical situation came up that you point out in your story. The Unemployment Insurance Agency had some big problems, and the first phone calls did come in to legislative staff about, you know, people being flagged for falsely for fraud. I mean, this is kind of how this story kind of bubbled up to the surface, right?
It's true. And it's funny, the Unemployment Agency has had this happen a few times over the years for different issues, where maybe the phone system goes down, and, you know, people, they're trying to get through and say, you know, I was accused of committing fraud, and I didn't do it, and I can't get through to anybody over there. So what do? They call their legislator. I mean, this is how a republic is supposed to work. They call their representative in state government or senator, and then that person tries to get some answers on their behalf. And it was really because, you know, so many calls were coming in. Legislators start to say, well, what is going on? And hearings were held. I mean, I can remember, this is several years ago, but as I mentioned on the phone system, the chair of the committee at the time that was overseeing the Unemployment Insurance Agency really chastising the officials from that agency, saying, you know, all I've been getting are calls from constituents about why they can't get through to your offices. So that, you know, legislators are sort of a safety valve in that respect.
Now, other states, of course, do have a part-time legislature, but I suppose it may be worth looking into this and what they do. But is perhaps the difference with Michigan that with a full-time legislature, we have come to expect this level of service. And if it were to all of a sudden go away, people may not be as wild about the idea of a part-time legislature.
Well, like I said, there's different types of part-time legislatures. You know, there's a lot of states that are, you know, maybe peer states to Michigan, have what the National Conference of State Legislatures calls hybrids, where they're part-time, but most legislators would say, well, about two-thirds of my work day or, you know, work year is being a legislator. I mean, so they, you know, it's not a full-time job like it is here in Michigan, but they spend a lot of time on it. But, you know, the proposal the lieutenant governor is envisioning says, you know, basically one quarter of the year would, you know, someone would be working legislative business, and then otherwise they would be returning to their private life, working their other career, or if they have one or whatnot. So that's where, you know, it's not so much that a part-time legislature is unique. In fact, a full-time legislature is more unique. Most
right.
States have part-time legislatures. But the type of part-time legislature that's being discussed, you don't see populous states, for the most part, that have legislatures that meet as little as this proposal calls for. The closest comparisons out there would be states like Montana, Maine, and South Dakota. And, you know, Michigan is a higher service state than those states with
bigger
population and a lot, more issues that the government deals with.
You mentioned there the idea that lawmakers could go back to their other career if they have one during the time the legislature is not in session. That led to an interesting blog post from your colleague at Gongward, John Lindstrom, wondering exactly who would be able to run for and serve in the legislature if you're looking at a period of time, say, in the first, 3 months of the year, where you'd have to say to your employer, well, I'm not going to be able to be here all of those 3 months or most days in those 3 months because I'm going to be serving in Lansing. I mean, I suppose there's questions about who can actually then hold that job and who are they working for at that point? Are they working for the state or are they working for their employer when they cast votes?
It's a big unknown. I mean, I know, most people's employers, I just cannot imagine, would say, go ahead and take 3 months off unless maybe you're working for an entity that has a lot of issues at the Capitol, and they say, well, you know what, this is a great idea. You could get elected to the legislature and make sure the interests of our company or our industry are represented. And, we've got a big enough staff, or we'll have people fill in and so forth. I know the lieutenant governor has said that, the biggest concern he had when he decided to run was leaving the career in banking he was starting, and it would have been easier had he been able to just take a few months being a legislator, but still having his career in banking. If this does happen, we'll just have to see who ends up, being in a position where they can do this.
But as you say, we'd have a combination of term limits and a part-time legislature, very strict term limits compared to most other states, and then a part-time legislature that would probably make the legislative branch weaker. And it's interesting that the Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly is pushing this right at the moment that everyone is expecting he is also going to launch a campaign to run for governor himself and head the executive branch.
I mean, there's been, and he's been asked this question, he's sort of punted it, is this a power play? You know, you're about to head the executive branch. This would really kneecap the legislative branch. I mean, think about it, where you'd have 9 months of the year where, think about Governor Snyder, how much time he has to spend reacting to whatever issue of the moment the legislature is talking about or threatening to put on his desk without his approval. If he had 9 months of the year where he didn't have to deal with that, he'd probably be thrilled.
You also point out that Brian Kelly made $79,000 plus annually during his 4 years in the House. So he was there while the salary was larger than it would be under his proposal. Of course, I suppose one thing he would say in his defense is that when he was a state lawmaker, he also at that time pushed for and proposed a part-time legislature.
He did. He co-sponsored a constitutional amendment to make Michigan's legislature part-time, but let's not confuse the two here. There is a big difference between co-sponsoring a proposal in the legislature, which had zero chance of ever moving. Not only was unlikely the legislature would be interested in it, it was under Democratic control at the time, so it was basically a freebie. I mean, I have no doubt that he believes in it. He put his name on it, but there were no real consequences of that. This is much different. This is putting the weight of his profile and position, hiring top-notch staff, raising big money to actually get this on the ballot. What he did before was basically a freebie with no consequences. This is saying, I am going to spearhead actually making the legislature part-time with a proposal that, if it gets on the ballot, has a very good chance of passing.
And also proposing it at a time when, again, everybody is expecting, although he has not formally announced, that he will run for governor, and therefore he will have a much bigger megaphone from which to make the case for a part-time legislature.
He's going to run for governor. I mean, that seems obvious. You don't raise $600,000. You're not sitting on $600,000 in your lieutenant governor campaign committee, which could be transferred to a gubernatorial committee for your health. So I think everybody's expecting that it's just a matter of time. And he's looking for an issue to allow him some separation. I mean, there's a long history of lieutenant governors falling flat when they run to try to succeed their boss, because inevitably they're tied, they're joined at the hip with the governor. But Michigan tends to look for change after 8 years of a governor. And you know, let's just face it, electing the current lieutenant governor is not, you know, what most people would see as change. So he's trying to separate himself, give himself his own identity away from Governor Snyder. You know, nonetheless, he is still Governor Snyder's lieutenant governor, and it's going to be difficult. But this is a part of what he's trying to do to separate himself.
So I want to read how you end this blog post. He is betting, and he is Lieutenant Governor Calley, and virtually everyone agrees that Michigan voters will take the same approach as they did in 1992 with term limits and stick it to those dastardly politicians. Is that your way of saying that if this gets on the ballot, the conventional wisdom is that voters will approve it?
I mean, let's face it, you know, elected officials are not popular these days. That's a bipartisan feeling. And I don't know, what do we think would happen if a proposal goes up on the ballot to cut legislative pay in half and, you know, make the legislature part-time? I mean, it'll be a big hurdle to try to defeat this. You know, there's already people in the Capitol community talking about organizing an opposition against it. And there's certainly some good arguments that they could make against it that could have some potency. But how do you counter cut legislative pay in half? That's going to be very difficult. There is still outrage to this day over the 38% pay increase the legislature effectively gave itself in the year 2000. It was 2001. People still remember that. It really damaged the institution's reputation with the public when it happened. And you better believe that that's going to be part of the mix if, you know, when the public looks at a proposal that would cut their pay in half.
Zach, as always, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Gongwer News Service editor Zach Gorchow joined us from the Michigan Public Radio Network studios in Lansing. A link to his blog post on the possible combination of a part-time legislature and Michigan's strict term limits can be found at WMUK.org. We recorded our conversation on Tuesday. The Board of State Canvassers was due to review the petition language for the part-time legislature proposal yesterday. But that meeting was called off when concerns about the legality of the petition language were raised by the State Attorney General's Office and the Bureau of Elections.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. 5 of the 9 current members of the Battle Creek City Commission are women. If you live in Battle Creek or follow the commission and haven't noticed, that could be seen as a sign of progress. With another election season about to get underway, Battle Creek Inquirer readers were recently introduced to the first woman to serve on the Battle Creek City Commission, Claire Briggs. The Inquirer's government reporter Jennifer Bowman wrote the story and joins us via Skype. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Gordon.
What got you interested in the story of Claire Briggs to begin with?
Well, it really started with trying to find another way to get readers more interested in the election, to let more people know that they can run for public office, they can get into local government. And so I just happened to come across her name in a list that the Inquirer would post every now and they'd publish, you know, 50 years ago today, 100 years ago today. And it was just one line saying that Claire Briggs was elected as the first female city commissioner. So I thought it would be an interesting story. That's all I could really find as far as any recent coverage. And so I did a little bit of digging and looking into our archives at the time that she was elected and found a pretty interesting woman who was doing a lot of impressive things during her time.
And what is the time frame that we're talking about here?
Well, she was elected in 1925. She was in her mid-50s at the time, and she died in 1936. So, you know, quite a while ago.
What were you able to find out about Claire Briggs' life and her background before she actually ran for Battle Creek City Commission?
Well, she went to the University of Michigan and got a bachelor's degree, which was not common during her time for a woman to do that. She was very active in the community. She was in many women's clubs. She did a lot of work in trying to register women for war work during World War I. And she had a pretty interesting background as far as her family goes. Her mother was one of the first female school board members elected in Battle Creek. Her dad was a well-known doctor who had some pretty progressive things to say about equal rights for women. And so those things kind of came as no surprise to me when you look at kind of what Claire Briggs accomplished. Oh, and she also had a patent for a toothbrush, which was a fun little snippet that I found.
So someone who's very involved in their community seems like a natural to run for city commission or some sort of local government board. But of course, we're talking many decades ago, and we're talking about a woman running for city commission at a time when there were no women who had previously won a seat on that board. So how was it viewed in the community at that time?
Yeah, I think you're right. Everything seems natural for a person with that kind of background and that kind of active life in the community to be a natural selection for the city commission. But you're right, she was a woman. And it's really interesting to read kind of the coverage then when she decided she was going to run and nomination packets were taken out for her. A woman's club made efforts to make sure that a woman was in every precinct to gather enough signatures to get her to get on the city commission. And they had a really interesting article that an old newspaper ran about calls that were made at the time on behalf of Claire Briggs trying to get folks to vote for her. And a lot of people had some really interesting things. They had an interesting description as the women who they talked to who were against any woman being on the ballot, they were considered non-club women, which I thought interesting. It seems like maybe the women's clubs at the time were more progressive and were kind of at the forefront of rights for women and all that. And then there was some interesting stuff that maybe you hear today, but certainly not as often and certainly not so easily printed in the paper about how a woman should not be in politics. She should not be in public office. And instead, she should be at home with the kids. And so it was really interesting to see kind of the response the community had when she ran for city commission.
In the quote you have from her, she kind of downplays the idea that she was, seeking this office because of gender or anything like that. She just said that she wanted to serve and thought it was sort of the natural thing to do with someone who thought that they could make the city a better place to live. But did you get the sense, you know, with some of the things you talked about there with, you know, making sure that she got on the ballot, you know, getting women into precincts, et cetera, that either Claire Briggs or people in the community recognized that it was an important moment that a woman was, you know, seriously running and could actually win a seat on the city commission?
Yeah, I don't know if the downplaying was maybe a strategy on their part, maybe to, calm the fears of a woman being on the city commission. But they were well aware, you know, that Claire was a woman and that may be a challenge. So it's been really interesting to kind of see that response and interesting that she downplayed that. It was a big deal in the community. If you look at the newspapers, it was on the front page and it emphasized the point that she was the first woman to even consider running for city commission. There was a woman who had considered running, but I guess didn't get a petition in time. And so that left her. But of all the reporting I can see, they were well aware she was a woman and the significance of that was definitely out there.
So she won election to the Battle Creek City Commission. How long did she serve?
She served just one term. There was a lot of reporting about her maybe running into disagreements, maybe some tension between her and the mayor at the time. So she narrowly lost re-election. She did try to get another term, but she didn't win. She lost by less than 200 votes. And it wouldn't be another almost 50 years until another woman would get on the city commission.
And that's interesting. There is that long gap between Claire Briggs and then the next woman to serve on the Battle Creek City Commission. But you did then talk to the women who serve on the Battle Creek City Commission now, or some of them. What do they say as they look back on that history?
I talked to Vice Mayor Susan Baldwin, and right now she is the longest serving woman who is currently on the commission. And what was interesting is that she had never heard of Claire Briggs before. What you would think would be a really big deal in this community, I think because we have such a rich history in Battle Creek, some great stories about our history. Some of even the good ones kind of get lost or forgotten along the way. So when I approached Vice Mayor Baldwin about this story, she looked into her and was just really amazed that in 1925, a woman who could go to college and who could have her own career and be kind of the not so typical. I mean, she was single. She never married. She never had children. She was kind of amazed that someone could accomplish that much in the year 1925. And she talked a little bit. She's only the third female mayor for the city of Battle Creek. So she talked about her and who's inspired her, who influenced her, and kind of the state of women in local government today. She said she'd really love to pick the brain of Claire Briggs if she were alive today.
Susan Baldwin also made a point of saying that she'd like to see, you know, more people from different backgrounds, you know, look into running for city commission, launch campaigns, et cetera. Is that part of what the timing here of your article does is maybe highlight the fact that, you know, there are people who bring different perspectives and people who, you know, come from different walks of life. And, you know, it's probably valuable to have people from a varied background to serve on local boards.
Yeah, you know, I've written in the past kind of about the makeup of our city commission and the demographics. A few years ago, I kind of looked at the ethnicities of the commissioners and how that compared to our citywide demographics. And, you know, for a Midwest city, you know, we're pretty diverse. We have a pretty sizable Burmese population, a Latino population. And so I think what Vice Mayor Baldwin said has been kind of echoed throughout the community of getting the representation on the commission would really help people kind of all ages, all backgrounds. And so it's been really interesting to see that, you know, today our city commission is majority female. But, you know, there's still some strides that can be made, I think, as far as who's getting elected and who they represent and their backgrounds.
What do we know about Claire Briggs post Battle Creek City Commission? Do we know details about her life, what she did after that?
It looked like she never really considered political office after that. I don't know. You know, I wish I could look back and see. You know, I'm sure there were a lot of discussions about whether she would or not. But she remained active in her clubs. And seemed to be still really well respected in the community. When she died, she had been battling some heart trouble for a few months before that. But the Inquirer wrote for her obituary that she was, you know, among the most respected club women in the community, and that a lot of people relied on her advice. So I think she died very well respected here, despite only serving one term.
As you mentioned earlier, a lot of people have not heard of her. Did you, as you did this story, see it as an opportunity to maybe let people know about, you know, a figure from the past in Battle Creek that they don't know a lot about, but someone that they could still be interested in?
Sure. I actually went out to her grave, and she's buried here at Oak Hill Cemetery. And, you know, no signs of visitors. I try to kind of track down some family members, but she's been gone a really long time, and so have people, her immediate relatives. But, you know, what she accomplished is no small feat, and I don't think that should kind of be quickly forgotten. She was the first female city commissioner, and as Vice Mayor Susan Baldwin described, she said that there's still some municipalities across Michigan who are just now electing their first female elected officials. So certainly this isn't a story that I think should be forgotten. And it's a really interesting piece of history and an interesting story about a woman who accomplished a lot for her time.
Jennifer, thank you very much for your time and for sharing this story with us.
Thank you.
Battle Creek Inquirer government reporter Jennifer Bowman joined us via Skype. Her story on Claire Briggs, the first woman to serve on the Battle Creek City Commission, can be found at battlecreekinquirer.com and through a link at wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.